This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Will the U.S. Supreme Court take another right turn? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Civil rights, states' rights, gun control, and abortion are just some of the issues raised by the president's latest nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. Samuel Alito has what Harriet Myers did not, a judicial record with 240 opinions and 41 dissents. Conservatives and liberals are ready for political warfare. On To the Point, how conservative are Alito's legal opinions? Is he an ideologue or a careful scholar? What are the prospects for a Senate filibuster? On Reporter's Notebook later on, tax reform and the homeowner's mortgage deduction. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Conservatives and liberals are prepared for a major battle over the president's latest appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. On To the Point, is Samuel Alito an ideologue or a careful scholar? We'll look at the legal record and the politics of Senate confirmation. On Reporter's Notebook, the president's panel on tax reform wants to eliminate tax breaks and make less work for CPAs. Is this the domestic agenda the White House needs? First, this news update. President Bush today called for $7.1 billion to prepare for a bird flu pandemic he said could kill the young and healthy as well as the old, the frail, and the sick.
Our country has been given fair warning of this danger to our homeland and time to prepare. My responsibility as the president to take measures now to protect the American people from the possibility that human-to-human transmission may occur.
President, speaking today at the National Institutes of Health, Maren McKenna is author of Beating Back the Devil, about the federal government's disease control efforts. She covers the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Maren, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
First of all, this term pandemic, exactly what does it mean?
A pandemic is actually has got a quite specific meaning. It's a term that indicates an epidemic or an outbreak that arises in many places simultaneously, a global epidemic, if you will.
All right. The president says we don't have one of those now, but as we just heard, that it's his responsibility to prepare for one. How unprepared are we?
The short answer is very unprepared. There's two things going on right now. The first is that people are very concerned about this particular strain of avian influenza that has been moving in poultry and waterfowl from Asia all the way now to Europe's Atlantic coast. The second is that, generally speaking, we know that pandemics of human flu arise about anywhere from every 10 to every 30 years. The last one was in 1968, and so we're considered very overdue for one. The National Pandemic Plan has actually been in the works since 1993, and many, many, many public health and infectious disease planners have been saying for some years that the U.S. is grossly unprepared and really needed to move much faster.
So here comes the outbreaks that you've just talked about, plus the demonstration of the federal government's problems in this regard because of Hurricane Katrina.
Yes, I think that it's fairly well understood now that preparing for a pandemic plan is offering the administration an attractive alternate narrative to what happened in Katrina and Rita. We do have a little more time now to get ready than we did apparently with Katrina. However, as with Katrina, there have been warnings for a very long time that there were vulnerabilities that needed to be addressed. And what the president said today in giving his address was he pretty much enumerated all the ways in which people have been saying for a number of years, we are not prepared. And he announced plans to get ready, but whether those plans will be ready in can be implemented in time for either avian flu or a pandemic coming from another source of flu is really an open question.
Maren McKenna, once again, a writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Are there not some problems with the fact that the virus can change itself very rapidly and the prospect that if you stockpile vaccines, for example, or medical drugs of one kind or another, they may not work for the virus strain? that ends up causing the pandemic.
That is exactly a problem, and it's been one of the problems with vaccine manufacture for flu right from the start, is that when we manufacture flu vaccine in this country, really around the world, we're using a technology that dates back to the late 1940s. It's never really been a priority in most circles to change that, because flu has never been considered a priority disease, even though in an average year, it kills 36,000 Americans and about 1 million people around the world. So that means that if a pandemic arises and we identify the strain that is moving very rapidly through people, it still will take about 6 months to get to the point of producing large quantities of a vaccine.
The president said today that vaccine makers need protection from liability. How much of a problem has that been in getting them to manufacture vaccines?
Well, it really depends on who you ask. Certainly, I think the pharma companies would say that is a very significant problem, and that goes all the way back to the pandemic that wasn't in 1976. People may have heard of the swine flu, when the Centers for Disease Control and Health and Human Services decided that there was a very imminent threat of a new flu strain arising and instituted a national vaccination program. As it turns out, it was not, in fact, a pandemic. The strain sort of petered out and didn't go very rapidly person to person. But several hundred people developed Guillain-Barré paralysis associated with that vaccination program. And ever since then, there's been sort of a shadow over pandemic planning of how rapidly can we push, how much liability will there be if something goes wrong with the vaccine.
So there are risks, whatever you do, and you can be damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Sadly, as with many things in science, nothing is 100%.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Maren McKenna, once again, science and medical writer at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, covers the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She's author of the book Beating Back the Devil on the federal government's disease control efforts. We will be back in a moment to talk about the Supreme Court nominee and whether it's time for another right turn for the U.S. Supreme Court. On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Wormen Alney back with To the Point. When he was nominated to an appellate court back in 1990, Samuel Alito was praised by Democrats as an apolitical public servant. Senate confirmation was unanimous. That was then. This is now. In 15 years, Judge Alito has written more than 240 opinions, including 41 dissents. Yesterday, when President Bush nominated him to the U.S. Supreme Court, conservatives and liberals prepared for what both sides called a historic confrontation. We'll take a look first at Alito's legal record and then at the politics of the confirmation process. Cass Sunstein is professor of constitutional law at the University of Chicago Law School. He clerked for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, and he is author of a book called Radicals in Robes. Professor Sunstein, welcome back to our program.
Thank you so much.
Would Judge Alito, is he, I should say, a radical in a robe?
I don't think so. By temperament, he's a cautious person whose rulings in particular cases are narrow rather than extravagant.
The president promised another justice in the mold of Scalia and Thomas. Are you saying that that's not what he's produced?
Well, what's very interesting is he's a little bit paradoxical in his record. That is, he doesn't have the kind of ambition in his writing of Scalia and Thomas, partly because he's a lower court judge, but I don't think that's the only reason. On the other hand, and this is the paradox, his opinions are fairly consistently conservative. I've focused especially on dissents, those opinions where he's departed from his colleagues, and in the vast majority, nearly every one, he's to the right of his colleagues. So his pattern of voting, to me, is very surprisingly conservative in a way that sets him up to be a likely Scalia-Thomas type in his conclusions.
So he isn't yet, but he might be in the future. Is that what you're saying?
Well, if you're asked, is this an O'Connor type who's unpredictable, who's essentially conservative, but who on some issues will depart from the Scalia-Thomas line, I don't think his record supports that. He's, by and large, a quite conservative judge in his ultimate conclusions. What is most striking, incidentally, is a little more particular than that, which is he defers to established institutions. If it's a prison, if it's a school, if it's the Immigration and Naturalization Service, if it's a college, if it's a police officer, he shows a real pattern of deferring to them in a way that is very striking to me. He doesn't show the kind of libertarian instincts that some conservatives do. So I think he's not bombastic. He doesn't have a theory. He's not arrogant. He's respectful. He's not an extremely stylish writer, as Scalia is. He doesn't show the kind of tremendous creativity and imagination that Scalia does. But his opinions, and you know, the spinners can think of counterexamples, but his opinions, by and large, are very, very conservative.
What would that mean in terms of abortion? That seems to be one issue that everybody's concerned about.
Well, I think it's hazardous to predict how any particular person is going to rule on a particular issue, but I'll give it a shot. I think the best bet, from what we've seen of his work in general, is that he'd be in favor of upholding restrictions on the abortion right that fall short of eliminating the abortion right. So things like notification requirements for parents, notification requirements for spouses, that sort of thing, there's direct and indirect evidence to believe he'd be sympathetic to. Unlike Justice O'Connor, incidentally, that would be a disagreement. I guess the $64,000 question, or with inflation, the $64 million question, is would he vote to overrule Roe against Wade? And I wouldn't want to speculate about that. Let me just say that if he did vote to overrule Roe against Wade, nobody should be surprised.
You are pretty much on the liberal side of the spectrum. Are you for or against Justice Alito?
I'm agnostic. I think that too many people on all sides are rushing to conclusions, either booing him as some sort of ogre or applauding him as the greatest thing in the history of the United States of America. And it's much too early. We need to learn something. In my politics, incidentally, are eclectic with respect to judges. I don't like activists of any kind, that is, people who want to invalidate a lot of legislation. I don't like that. What kind of person he'd be on the Supreme Court, I think we should think first and decide later. I hope that's not a surprising or odd thought.
Cass Sunstein, professor of constitutional law, University of Chicago Law School, once again a clerk for the late Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. John McGinnis is professor of law at Northwestern University, formerly was in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department. He was there during the Reagan and first Bush administrations and worked with Judge Alito there. Professor McGinnis, welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
What can you tell us about the judge that we haven't already heard from Cass Sunstein, or do you disagree with what we heard from Cass Sunstein?
Well, why don't I begin, since I do have the advantage of having worked personally with him, to give you some picture of that. I had the experience of being a line attorney when he was a deputy assistant attorney general at the Office of Legal Counsel, and I thought he was a wonderful attorney, a deliberate, cautious, indeed, of course, this was at the time of the so-called Reagan Revolution in law, where there were many people who were very much against, I think, the established order in law, and some for some good reasons. I think the interesting thing about Judge Alito then in the Justice Department was the way he was quite interested in continuity and stability as well. He had been a civil servant in the FG's office and was coming into a political appointment in Office of Legal Counsel, but I think he brought many of the virtues, actually, of the civil service into his perspective in OLC and was a kind of ballast and against too rapid or too unconsidered kinds of changes. And so the person I knew at OLC was a very deliberate and thoughtful and cautious lawyer.
And that person, of course, got unanimous confirmation from the U.S. Senate when he was first appointed in 1990 to the appellate court. But now we have 15 years of a judicial record. Cass Sunstein says the pattern is very consistently conservative and that he would not be unpredictable, as he thought Justice O'Connor was by comparison.
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, I may agree in some sense, but maybe for somewhat different reasons. I think the reason that he is somewhat predictable is I do think he takes a text and precedent extremely seriously, I think probably more seriously than Justice O'Connor does. and that will give him a certain predictability in the law. It is the fact, I think, that what is called conservatism in law is really about a methodology of jurisprudential approach. And after all, what's important about law is the reasons lawyers give. And I think he has a kind of distinctive set of reasons that he gives for his results that are the reasons that he reaches them. It's not really that he's coming to some ideological result one way or the other, but because he's very focused on the text and the precedent is really settling the case and trying to get rid of all concerns of his the way he prefers to come out. And I think that is actually a difference between what is called the conservative approach to judging and what's called the liberal approach to judging. And it goes quite deeply into a view of distrust. I think liberals have been much more confident in elites' judgments that they should be able, we should give them some deference, judges some deference in their decision and their own values. And I think conservatives are less likely to do that. And so that's the real difference here, that he's going to be very much focused on text and precedent, and therefore will be more predictable. I don't think predictability in law is a vice.
Would he then vote, do you think, to uphold Roe versus Wade?
I'm just have no idea about what his decision about that is in any event. In some sense, that's a meta question about predictability. The question there is Roe v. Wade a decision that is so much a departure from the text and structure of the Constitution that its very existence is a kind of going to be an engine of unpredictability and lack of stability in the law, because it's going to create a way for judges to pour their own values into the law through substantive due process. That's the hard question about Roe v. Wade, and I don't know how he would answer it.
John McGinnis, professor of law at Northwestern University, worked with Judge Alito before he was a judge at the Reagan and first Bush Justice Departments. Back to Cass Sunstein at the University of Chicago. Obviously, we're going to hear in a moment about the politics of all of this from interest groups on each side. And abortion isn't the only red meat issue that they are interested in. There's also civil rights, states' rights, gun control, religion and government. What can you tell us when you say that he is consistently conservative about the cases he's decided, not in all of those areas? Don't mean to make you go down a list here, but what is it that makes you think, as a result of his decisions, that he would come out with the same kinds of conclusions as Scalia and Thomas?
Yeah, well, one thing that can't be said is that he follows precedent and text and his colleagues don't. The cases where he's leaning to the right are ones where the precedents and the text don't speak clearly. So the idea that he is a good lawyer is being lawful and these other judges are being liberal, lawless people, that's a preposterous characterization of the situation. So to get to some particulars, there's a case where prisoners were forbidden from receiving newspapers or magazines from the publisher, from the prison library. The Court of Appeals ruled that violated their First Amendment rights under law that had no clear precedent. Judge Alito dissented, saying it did not violate their First Amendment rights that prisoners could be blocked from getting newspapers or magazines. There's a case in which a 10-year-old girl and her mother were strip searched by the police under a warrant that didn't authorize the strip search. They sued, saying their constitutional rights were violated. The court said that the violation of the constitutional rights in this bodily search of a little girl was so clear that the police officers didn't have qualified immunity. Judge Alito said the judges did have qualified immunity.
You mean police did have...
Right. The police had qualified immunity. There was a case in which there was a religious institution, a Hindu temple, that was trying to get permission to use its land the way it wanted, and there were all sorts of conditions imposed by the local zoning board. A lot of listeners maybe can identify with that, and the conditions included they had to have off-duty police officers there for no apparent reason, and the court ruled these were arbitrary and unlawful conditions on the Hindu temple. The court thought this made no sense, these conditions. Judge Alito dissented, saying that the conditions were okay, and a couple, that is the land use conditions imposed on the Hindu temple, were reasonable. There were cases involving employment discrimination in which the court ruled this case could go to a jury because the facts had been shown adequately. Judge Alito said twice, big cases depend on the facts. He said, no, it couldn't go to the jury. The jury couldn't find this. It's a case in which two parents lost their son who had been killed at a college because they hadn't taken adequate care of him, even though he had a bad health condition. They sued for a wrongful death action. The court ruled that this could go to the jury. Judge Alito ruled that the case could not go to the jury, that the parents of the dead youngster were out of legal luck.
Okay, step back then from those examples and make a generalization then about what that says about Judge Alito's record.
Yes, well, it's noteworthy, and I should say I'm not an opponent of Judge Alito. I'm interested in learning more about him. He's certainly someone of quality and character, and that's terrific, as well as experience. But what is noteworthy, I think, even more than in the Scalia-Thomas stuff, is that he is deferring to established institutions, whether it's a zoning board or the Immigration and Naturalization Service or a prison that's blocking people from getting written material or police officers who've stripped somebody. The record in his dissents of deferring to established institutions, it really stands out.
Okay.
I've never seen anything like it.
Professor McGinnis, back to you, a friend and colleague formerly of Judge Alito. What do you say? What do you draw? What conclusion do you draw from those examples?
Well, first of all, I want to respond to Professor Sunstein's remark that it is preposterous to say that Justice Judge Alito is following text and precedent. I don't think that's right. This, again, is a deep disagreement about law. Liberals believe that there is inevitably some aspect of a substantial aspect of discretion in judges' rulings, and that they should fill it with their own preferences. I think we may see, actually, the reverse here from Justice Alito. What he believes is, and I think this is a perfectly respectable and long-time understanding of how law works, that unless the judge can show that there is some text and precedent against the government action is to be upheld. So it goes back as a very venerable theory of how judges should exercise their power, and that shows that what the judge is doing is simply going no farther than the law permits him in supervising the other branches of government. So
what about deference to institutions? The question here,
I do think, is a disagreement about the nature of what judges ought to do.
Okay, and again, we have 15 seconds until we need to go to a break, so I don't want to ask you a question that requires a lengthy answer, but do you think that this judge would defer to other institutions in the way that Cass Sunstein suggested?
I certainly don't think there's any evidence in his record that he will defer to institutions when they violate the text of the Constitution. I think he will defer to other institutions into the democratic accountability of branches.
Okay.
when they make their own decisions, and there is nothing in the text of the Constitution that invalidates them.
John McGinnis, professor of law at Northwestern University. We'll continue on after a brief break on Reporter's Notebook. Will the Bush White House seize the moment for a try at federal tax reform? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Allen back with To the Point, talking today about the President's nomination of Samuel Alito, an appellate court judge, to be the next member of the U.S. Supreme Court, replacing Sandra Day O'Connor. As we have heard, lawyers can disagree about his massive record, 240 opinions, 41 dissents. We heard from Cass Sunstein, professor of constitutional law at the University of Chicago, pretty much a liberal, but says he's agnostic with regard to this nomination. Nonetheless, he sees in the judge's opinions a very consistently conservative person. We also heard from John McGinnis, former colleague of Judge Alito before he became a judge, professor of law now at Northwestern University, who says that he thinks that unless there's a precedent or a legal standard, then the Judge Alito would pretty much defer to the government in various situations, which we heard described. Let's go now to the battle for confirmation, first, of course, at the Judiciary Committee of the U.S. Senate, and the groups on both sides are lined up, ready to go, and we may see a long and expensive battle waged by, among others, Ralph Nees, who's president of the People for the American Way. That's a liberal nonprofit, organizes on constitutional rights issues. Ralph Nees, it's always good to have in our program.
It's always an honor. Thank you, Warren.
What will you say about Judge Alito and his qualifications and his appropriateness as a member of the U.S. Supreme Court?
Warren, we certainly stated yesterday that, sadly, President Bush has, in a five-day period, capitulated to the radical right. Number one, of course, having to withdraw the Harriet Myers nomination last Thursday, and then nominating someone in the mode of Clarence Thomas, Antonin Scalia, and Robert Bork. Samuel Alito is definitely someone who represents a right-wing judicial philosophy. He truly is an early Christmas present to Manny Miranda and those on the right. If he joins with Thomas and Scalia, especially because he'll be replacing Sanjay O'Connor, a mainstream conservative who has been the fifth and decisive vote on so many key constitutional issues on both sides, of course, of the judicial philosophy spectrum. But in recent years, she really has helped protect privacy, reproductive rights, equal opportunity, clean air, clean water, religious liberty, and so many other issues. So this is a watershed moment. This is probably the most important and controversial nomination since the Bork nomination, and it's only the second time since the 1930s that the court has been so evenly balanced, basically 4-4. It happened in 1987, and now it's happening. And what happens over the next month or two or three could well determine the law of the land in many key constitutional areas for 20 or 30 or 40 years.
We just heard from Cass Sunstein, who's authored a book called Radicals in Robes, and he says that he doesn't think that this judge is, in fact, a radical in a robe, and particularly that he lacks what he referred to as the ambition of Scalia and Thomas to make the kind of radical changes that you are suggesting. Why do you think he is such a person?
Jonathan Turley, who's usually a lot more conservative than my friend Cass, who I taught with at the University of Chicago Law School, said that Alito was to the right of Scalia in published comments on network TV yesterday. But if you look at the record, especially with respect to privacy, with respect to the Commerce Clause and the congressional authority under the Commerce Clause, as well as civil rights issues, there's no question that he is in the mode of Thomas Scalia and Bork. In privacy, for example, in a dissent, Alito would have upheld the strip search of a mother and her 10-year-old daughter, even though the warrant allowing the search did not name either of them. In fact, Judge Michael Chertoff, of course now head of the Department of Homeland Security, criticized that position as threatening to turn the Constitution's search warrant requirement into little more than a rubber stamp. I think many people are now familiar with the Casey decision. In dissent again, Alito would have upheld a provision of Pennsylvania's restrictive anti-abortion law requiring a woman in certain circumstances to notify her husband before obtaining an abortion. His colleagues on the Third Circuit and, of course, the Supreme Court would have none of that. A lot of people are calling him Machine Gun Sammy now for his dissent in the Rybar case, where he said that the Interstate Commerce Clause did not give Congress the power to enact the law that it did, banning the sale of machine guns at gun shows. On the Family and Medical Leave Act, he voted and was, of course, overturned later by the Supreme Court and said that state employees were not covered with respect to monetary damage under the Family and Medical Leave Act. I could go on and on and on.
Okay.
We've done our 25-page report, but I think that gives you a sense of how far to the right he is. Very consistent, and I think the best parallel is Robert Bork, but very consistent with Thomas and Scalia, which is what the right definitely wants.
All right. Robert Bork, of course, appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court by Ronald Reagan, turned down after a very divisive battle in the U.S. Senate. Mentioned a moment ago by Ralph Nees, our next guest is Manuel Miranda, former nominations counsel to Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, senior nominations counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee, now still active in this area and is a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Emmanuel Miranda, welcome back to our program.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you and good to be with Ralph.
Is Judge Alito to the right of Scalia?
Well, no, obviously he's not.
What do you mean, obviously?
Well, it's obvious because of his own decisions, and in fact, the record of Scalia before he joined the court was rather indicative of a very different sort of career, a scholarly career. You know, I don't disagree entirely with the view of Cass Sunstein that Scalia does have a particular scholarly approach, as did Robert Bork. That is not true of the record of Sam Alito, who comes from a very different sort of different path. And in the same way, you might say that John Roberts came from a different path as Scalia or as Bork. And so this is a guy who has a very varied experience, a base of experience, and it produces a very different sort of man.
Different in what way when he becomes a judge? And what do you look at when you see the record? Cass Sunstein said he may not be a Scalia, but that he is consistently a conservative and might make the same kinds of decisions, conclusions, as Scalia and Thomas.
Well, I agree with Ralph. This is a watershed. This is the product of the American people's election of a Republican president and a Republican majority in the Senate. And what the problem that the left is having, especially the radical left, is that they see the great division of the American people and that they're on the losing side of that division, and it's really the product of an election. So it doesn't surprise me at all that a Republican president would choose a conservative judge, a constitutionalist, someone who looks, in the case of Casey, to the right of the people of Pennsylvania to determine their own laws and their own future and not to look to the federal judiciary to tell them what to do. And that is a perfectly natural. Now, mind you, there are pro-lifers, as one small aspect of the conservative movement, that view some of his decisions, for example, on the partial birth abortion case, as problematic. So there are pro-lifers today who are calling, who are not happy with this nomination.
What did he do on the partial birth case that disappointed conservatives?
Well, he followed the Stenberg decision, which basically followed the ban on partial birth abortion. And so there are pro-lifers today who think that he's not a judge like Scalia or like Thomas.
He turned down the idea of a partial birth abortion ban on the grounds that it didn't protect the rights of the mother to live. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Let me go back to Ralph Nees, and let me ask you a very different kind of question. Again, the president of People for the American Way. Is it appropriate, and are you going to encourage senators to vote against a candidate who everybody seems to agree is well qualified, certainly knows how to write an opinion, because they disagree with his judicial philosophy? Is that what you're asking?
Warren, there's no doubt about that. Over the last 200-plus years, about 20 to 25% of all Supreme Court nominees have been rejected, usually because of judicial philosophy. Like Judge Roberts, like Robert Bork, like Antonin Scalia, I believe that Alito has excellent legal credentials. I'm sure that his character is unquestioned. He's a person of integrity. This will be an epic struggle, a titanic battle between two competing and radically different judicial philosophies. Manny represents one. I represent another. And this is a good, healthy debate. I hope there's a public discussion, a national conversation about what's at stake. Our point of view, obviously, is the magnitude of what's at stake is extraordinary. And we did a report at the People of the American Way Foundation several years ago. We update it every year. If Thomas and Scalia get a majority, more than 100 Supreme Court precedents will be overturned, affecting privacy, affecting equal opportunity, religious liberty, clean air, clean water.
We just heard, though, that Judge Alito is a man who sticks with precedent.
He might stick with some precedents when he's on the circuit court. But, of course, the reason that Robert Bork was approved unanimously for the D.C. Circuit Court was he was a person who would act consistently with precedents at that level. But at the Supreme Court, you make precedents. It's not the same thing. The standard is very different. And Manny was saying before about his respect for elected bodies. Of course, with the Family and Medical Leave Act, he was willing to contravene what Congress had done with the Family
Family and Medical Leave Act. Also with the machine gun case, Congress had passed the law, and he tried to invalidate it. So he doesn't have a lot of respect for Congress and seems willing to invalidate the Commerce Clause interpretations of the last 50 or 60 years.
Ralph Neese, People for the American Way. Back to Manuel Miranda. You were formerly the nominations counsel to the Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. You certainly know how to count the numbers in the Senate at the moment. What do you think about the prospect of a filibuster and the so-called nuclear option, which would mean changing the rules to require a smaller number of senators in order to overturn a filibuster or override it?
I think it's very unlikely that there will be a filibuster. I mean, there are even among the Democrats, there are about 10 to 15 Democrats that would not follow Ralph and the special interest groups on the left, down the hallway, let alone into a filibuster at this point. And if there were a filibuster, I think the majority is perfectly able and willing to end the practice of judicial filibusters. You know, one of the things that Ralph just said about the FMLA and other acts of Congress is that, of course, this is where we divide. A conservative judge is well placed and justified to knock down an act of Congress that has gone past, that has overreached and gone past the bounds of the Constitution. And Ralph now calls that judicial activism. I call that exactly what the court is supposed to do.
Back to Ralph Neese. Do you think that a filibuster is possible in the first place? And secondly, given what you said about a healthy debate, is it a good idea?
Number one, we're asking senators, Democrat and Republican senators now, not to take a position until after the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings. After those hearings, when Manny's side and our side has a chance to testify, but most importantly, the nominee has a chance to testify, I think there's a good chance that a bipartisan majority will reject the confirmation of Samuel Alito. If I'm wrong, I do think there's a good chance that, as Senator Reid has said and as Senator Schumer and others have said, the filibuster is on the table. There was a massive effort last spring by Frist and by Lott. They thought they had, and Manny thought they had, 53 votes to end the filibuster and invoke the nuclear option. However, there was an extraordinary campaign led by people for, with the Mr. Smith Goes to Washington ads, that moved public opinion 20 points. Now it's a 2-1 majority against the nuclear option in favor of the filibuster. The vote was too close to call. Neither Bill Frist nor Harry Reid knew exactly where the vote count was. It was a toss-up, and the gang of 14 intervened on May 23rd, and obviously we've got this compromise, which could be temporary, we're not sure. But my gut is that it's a more favorable political environment for us than it was on May 23rd, because at that time, the president was doing much better in terms of his popularity in the country. And, of course, it was in a bit of a political vacuum. You didn't have a Supreme Court confirmation battle going on. I don't think the American people or a majority of the Senate, right in the middle of this kind of heated debate, are going to eliminate a rule that's been part of the Senate for over 200 years.
Manny Miranda, back to you. You were very much part of the organized effort to get Ms. Myers, Harriet Myers, to withdraw, which, of course, ultimately she did without an up or down vote, even in the Judiciary Committee, much less the whole Senate. And it is widely believed that the president was somewhat weakened by that because he had to withdraw her, or she withdrew her nomination. Do you think that this is the time for a titanic battle for a president who has so many problems on so many fronts, Iraq, the Katrina response, and so on and so forth?
I do. Not in terms of titanic or Armageddon, anything like that. I kind of like the way that Ralph said it earlier, and I agree entirely. And Ralph deserves a great deal of credit for popularizing the debate over the judiciary. And I believe that this is a time for a great national debate, a great national conversation. And the president shied away from that debate in naming Harriet Myers. They were a little bit controversy shy. And I think that with this nomination, we're going to get a national debate. And it's well-deserved and well had by the American people. It's something that we should take pride in. At the end of the day, Sam Alito is going to be confirmed. Is going to be confirmed by a pretty solid majority, and there's not going to be any need for ending the filibuster. The filibuster is on the table, and so is the nuclear option. And so that will be the restraining aspect that will restrain Democrats at after the hearings are done.
So you think, then, that this is a done deal?
Oh, yes. Ralph mentioned Christmas earlier, and I said earlier this morning that if the Alito family had Senate confirmation on the Christmas list, they can check it off because it's in the bag.
Ralph Nies, back to you. There's a lot of evidence from polls and elsewhere that people are tired of the polarization of politics. They want to see more harmony in Washington. Is this a good time for the Democrats to wage what you've referred to as a titanic struggle? Will that be good for them looking forward to the midterm elections coming up next year?
Well, we certainly wanted the president to nominate someone in the mode of Sandra Day O'Connor, a mainstream conservative, rather than someone who would divide the country. So we were hoping the president, especially in this time of international and domestic turmoil, would reach across the aisle and work with the Democrats and Republicans and come up with a consensus candidate who could unite the country. Regrettably, one more time, he's chosen confrontation over compromise and consensus. Manny was absolutely correct about the president. If you win an election, you have an absolute constitutional right to nominate a Supreme Court justice. Of course, the Senate has a co-equal constitutional right to reject that nominee, as it has done more than 20% of the time over the last 215 years or so.
Very, very quickly, Manny Miranda, do you think, are there any Republicans, Olympia Snowe, for example, who might be persuaded to vote against this nominee based on his votes on abortion and rights for women and those other issues?
I doubt it very much. The two Republicans who are most likely are Chafee and Snowe, who are running for re-election, and I suspect that even in Rhode Island and in Maine, most people think that a husband should be informed if a wife should want to get an abortion. I don't think that Alito is going to scare anybody up there.
Rhode Island, the home of Lincoln Chafee, the Republican senator from there. Well, gentlemen, thank you. The battle is on, obviously. Manuel Miranda, formerly with the Senate leader Bill Frist, and now a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Good to have you. Ralph Nies, president of the People for the American Way. Good to have you as well. And thanks to our legal experts, John McGinnis of Northwestern, Cass Sunstein of the University of Chicago Law School. We will be hearing a lot more about Samuel Alito before this is over. After a year of public meetings, the president's advisory panel on tax reform has provided him with a menu of options. But the panel itself says that while tax reform is a noble goal, it requires political will because of so many interest groups who will defend their breaks, their deductions, and their loopholes. Is this the domestic initiative the Bush White House needs after weeks of setbacks? More in a moment on that on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Foreman only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. President Bush has two plans before him for the first reform of federal tax laws since 1986. Jeffrey Birnbaum wrote about that episode in a book called Showdown at Gucci Gulch. He reports on finances for The Washington Post. Jeffrey Birnbaum, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Warren.
Two plans by this special advisory committee, roughly speaking. How do they differ? What are they?
Well, they really aren't that much different. They are there are two plans that differ primarily in the way that businesses are treated, but the revamping of the taxes for individuals are pretty much the same. And in each instance, most deductions and credits would be either trimmed back or eliminated or replaced, meaning that what this group is doing, what this panel is proposing, is a significant revamping of the federal income tax.
Would that include a elimination of the mortgage deduction?
No, not an elimination of it, though some of the screaming from the realtors and other housing groups would make you think so. It would be a scaling back of the mortgage interest deduction so that the wealthiest 5% of Americans would not be able to write off all of their mortgage interest deductions. Depending on how expensive a housing market you're in, that's how much that'll determine how much of your mortgage interest you'd be able to write off.
Realtors, just one of the well-financed groups, of course, that have voices in Washington. What are some of the other deductions and tax breaks that would be, if not eliminated, scaled back? And what kind of response could we expect from the people who support them?
Well, insurers are not all that happy because the employer-provided health insurance also would be capped the same in a similar way that the mortgage interest deduction would be capped, essentially per family, $11,500 worth of what are now tax-free health insurance could still be given tax-free by employers, but over that, those benefits would be taxed. And perhaps even a bigger change would be the elimination of the deduction for state and local tax payments. We can now, if you're an itemizer, can write off your state and local tax payments, and that makes a very big difference if you live in a high-tax state, let's say like California or New York. And so I expect a lot of governors and mayors, especially in those places, to scream as well.
What about, then, the prospect of the Bush White House at this point to pushing for this? What are the benefits that the advisory committee is offering in exchange for what could be painful for a lot of people?
Well, there are always winners and losers when it comes to reform of the tax code. In addition to what some of the pain that we mentioned, the tax proposals would also lower tax rates, would reduce the number of brackets, would cut back significantly in the amount of paperwork that people would have to deal with. Those are some of the benefits. And for a president who essentially lost his chief domestic initiative this year, that is the addition of private accounts to Social Security, and a president who needs a political boost, that's for sure, if judging by the polls, having a proposal that at least purports to simplify and make fairer the entire tax code could be an initiative that he's willing to champion. And so I think despite the obstacles, there's a decent chance that sometime at the end of this year or early next year, the president will get a formal proposal from the Treasury Department, and he may embrace it or at least parts of it, because he needs a new domestic agenda.
Talking to Jeffrey Birnbaum, a financial reporter for The Washington Post, you mentioned fairness. The president's had a lot of criticism over the fairness of the tax cuts, widely believed to help the rich at the expense of the middle class and the poor. Could that same criticism be raised at these plans?
Yes, and I think they will be. For example, all of those cuts that you mentioned, they are assumed, even though many of them sunset, that is, they disappear in the next few years, they are assumed to be extended in both of the plans that the panel is proposing, and that's one reason why Democrats in particular are shouting. But there are also reductions in tax rate for the wealthiest Americans, for corporations. The top tax rate is also reduced somewhat, and I think more importantly, the taxes on investment, things like capital gains and the like, in some instances, those will also be further reduced, adding on to the tax reductions that the president pushed through Congress earlier in his administration.
Well, what's in this, then, for the middle class, the people whose mortgage deduction and the ability to deduct state and local taxes, for example, is really very important at the end of the year?
Well, those are not for the middle class, those particular deductions that you mentioned. They are for itemizers only, meaning only the essentially middle and upper class, income
okay,
folks.
Okay, higher income. But certainly people who vote.
No, no. Yeah, mm-hmm. We're talking about two different things, though. There are trade-offs in here. For the mortgage interest deduction cap, the health insurance cap, those will be preventing upper-income people from getting the full tax benefit of those deductions. The state and local tax deduction falls disproportionately benefits disproportionately upper-income people. And so there are trade-offs. And, in fact, the president's panel says, though we haven't seen these numbers exactly, says that it's the same burden on each income class as the current system in each of their two proposals. Now, I'm looking forward to seeing if that's true. And remember, those distributional charts, as they're called, are also based on the extension of what have been highly criticized tax cuts already. But nonetheless, it doesn't. In other words, the panel says that the distribution of tax benefits does not get any worse under their proposals than now exists. If you don't like that distribution at the moment, well, then you still have problems with these proposals.
Plenty of room for differences of interpretation and confusion, as I suspect my questions have reflected. What does that mean for the prospect of actually getting this from the Congress, or some portion of it from the Congress, in a year when all the Congress and a big chunk of the Senate is going to be up for reelection?
Well, I wouldn't bet on it. If we're talking about the president trying to push the idea of tax reform, I think there's a decent chance. Whether he actually gets it, I'm not sure that the same kinds of reasons why it succeeded in 1986 are around today. For one thing, when it comes to taxation, one of the big problems is the size of the budget deficit, and neither of these plans do anything to reduce the budget deficit, and that's a problem. There's not a real
outcry. They do, though, make sure that the government is going to continue to take in as much as it currently does. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay.
But we'll add, we'll do nothing to reduce what are now $300 billion a year deficits, which is, I think, what the Congress believes is a higher priority. In addition, there, even though the public doesn't much like the current income tax system, there doesn't seem to be a real overwhelming popular need to revamp the whole system. In other words, the system back in 1986 was in danger of collapsing, the entire voluntary filing system, because people distrusted the system. It hasn't quite reached that level this time.
Jeffrey Birnbaum, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Financial reporter for The Washington Post, commentator on Fox News Channel, and the co-author of Showdown at Gucci Gulch. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Cameron Radziner and Jonah King, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.